This is how we overcome. We're moving to the kingdom. Reaching to the world with arms open. Arms open, yeah. This is how we practice grace.
Well, welcome back to Crazy Faith Talk. I'm Erica.
I'm Sarah.
And I'm Steve.
So we are in the middle of a series called Voices Other Than Our Own, where we each have been picking out theologians and religious leaders who are not from our tradition, so not Methodist, not Lutheran, and exploring what their work and lives have meant for our own faith journeys. So where are we, or who are we going to learn about today, Steve?
Well, I wanted to explore at least a little bit of an introduction to a writer I've gotten a little more familiar with in the last year or so, but who's been around and a prolific writer for decades. Her pen name is Bell Hooks. She was born Gloria Jean Watkins and took as a pen name Bell Hooks, all in lowercase, as a nod to her maternal great-grandmother, who was named Bell Bailey Hooks or something like that. So it's sort of a nod to her great-grandmother. She was born in the early 1950s in a small town in Kentucky. Since then, as had a career as a scholar and a writer, I guess most people who are familiar with her, not entering this from a theology kind of angle, are probably familiar with her writings about like the intersection of race and gender. She's one of those writers who like early on talked what now might be called intersectionality, that like there are ways that race plays a role in how you see the world in our culture, and also gender does. And so she is a voice probably earlier than it was fashionable or cool to say it, that would have said that in particular Black women and women of color have a unique voice, maybe that's different than the perspective that only white women who've only experienced what it's like to be treated differently based on being female, and that Black women also have a unique perspective because of their, racial, gender, all those, and that there's a bunch of ways that where we come from in life shape the way we see the world. That's one piece of what she's well known for. She's also one of those voices, like many would be now, I think, who would use the title or the category feminist of themselves to say that feminism is for everybody. That's a frequent tagline of hers, that like to be a feminist is basically for men or women or anybody to say that everybody should be treated equally rather than forcing them to fit in particular stereotypical roles or assumptions or things like that. So that's sort of maybe what the wider secular world might know her for or be familiar with. I have been most intrigued by a trilogy she wrote in the, I want to say, early 2000s, at least starting, that are exploring the notion of love. And there are ways that delves into the explicitly spiritual or theological, and ways that her conversation looks at human relationships as well, just, you know, whether romantic or friend or community or whatever. But an entry point that I'll sort of use for my purposes for introducing us today is her book All About Love, New Visions. It's the first of her what became a trilogy about the notion of the ways we practice love with one another. And one of the things that I found interesting for her is she's somebody who clearly had a background growing up within Christianity. There are ways in her writings she's certainly got a familiarity with what it would have been like to grow up as a young Black girl and Black woman in small town Kentucky. So there's Black church sort of lingo in the way she writes sometimes. As her own spiritual life progressed, she has had times where she has like experimented or explored Buddhism. So in that ways reminds me a little bit of our sort of glancing conversation about Thomas Merton last time around with Andre Nouwen, and has had times where she's been immersed or at least explored Sufi mysticism, which is sort of the mystical branch in Islam. And her writing also reveals at least a familiarity with the kind of like vague spirituality that might be called like the line between self-help and New Age and sort of modern psychology. Those all kind of blur at some point. One of the things I found helpful or interesting for reading her is number one, she's somebody who knows the language and the background of the way the church talks about love. And so it's not like this is foreign to her, but she also knows what it's like to be let down by institutional Christianity. And for me then, as someone whose personal theology and professional life are very much attached to the institution that is organized or not always very organized religion, it seems important to me always to listen to those voices of folks who've grown up with it and have felt like something was missing or something had been so badly damaged in that they felt like they couldn't be exactly a part of it. So like I find myself when I read bell hooks, like I'm excited when she'll quote a Bible verse and go, see, look, she likes the Bible. And then I'll also be like, okay, so she sees like the beauty of 1 John, perfect love casts out fear, or will quote a passage of Henri Nouwen or Thomas Merton in her writings. And then she'll also have this way of talking about how very often organized Christianity, maybe especially 20th century American Christianity, has sort of sometimes done a bait and switch where we'll talk in one breath about the importance of love and treating and honoring everybody and truth telling and justice. And then in the next breath, we'll move to, and what that means is women, you need to do these things, and men, you need to do these things. You need to fit these sort of cookie cutter rules. And she's one of those voices who's like, wait a second here. I think you've, you know, done a bait and switch here. That maybe you've lost something or confused a particular cultural assumption about how the world is supposed to be and assumed that that's what Christianity is. Well, maybe that's not what it is. And I guess she forces me to wrestle with that bigger theological question of how do any of us who own the traditions we come from. So here I am, a dyed in the wool Lutheran Christian who is like, I own that. And that's essential to who I am. How do I also discover that people who don't share my faith, there are going to be some places where they have insights that are helpful to me, even folks who are outside the traditional boundaries of Christianity. There are there things I can learn from Sufi mystic poets? And yeah, I'm like, my goodness, there's beauty in the way a poet like Rumi, the ancient Persian poet, will talk about the love of God in ways that I need to at least wrestle. Wow, folks whose faith is very, very different from mine also came to a deep understanding of the love of God. I can't ignore that because it's inconvenient. What do I do with that? Or the fact that folks from bell hooks to Thomas Merton to folks I've known personally in life have found that there was an awful lot of convergence for them between the practice of Buddhism and their Christianity. So me, rather than just saying, sorry, I can't learn anything from anybody who has anything positive to say about a different religion, how do I discover, these voices I don't have to be afraid of, but I can listen to them and discover they may help me see blind spots that I would prefer not to acknowledge exist. So she's been helpful for me as a voice like that.
I think that acknowledgement of institutions often fail us is something that we all wrestle with. In particular, I'm curious as if whether bell hooks would consider herself a feminist or a womanist. And
go ahead.
Because like her tagline of feminism is for everyone kind of says to me that she might continue to latch on to the identity of feminist. But one of the major failings of the feminist movement is that it did not really leave room for women of color. And at least the problems that are specific to women of color, you know, that there wasn't room for that intersectionality of, yes, there are issues and problems that women in general face. But then when you start looking at also the problems that like Black women face. You know, those are going to be different. And so the womanist movement was born out of feminism not really leaving room in the movement for women of color. And to me, the fact that there needed to be a womanist movement says something about feminism and how it failed. But now that that movement exists, I think that feminism needs to support the womanist movement. But so I'm kind of curious if she self-identifies as a feminist or a womanist or both, like, because like you can also be both.
Yeah. And it would be interesting to have that conversation or to read more in depth, particularly on how she views those categories and those labels. With my limited knowledge of her writing, I would say my guess would be that she would support the project of womanism as a sort of separate reality of like exploring how women of color have unique contributions that are not just the same as white women who have not experienced the additional challenges of racism or something like that. But in the pieces that I've read of her, she doesn't spend the time talking about dissecting those labels. It may well be she's done that elsewhere, and I'll just own I've got a limited entry point into her writing and have been most intrigued by or most focused, at least in my reading of her, at where are the places where her exploration of what love looks like, both human love and love with the divine. What does that look like, and what are the voices that need to be listened to there? But I think if I got to have a round two conversation on bell hooks or catch up with me in a couple of years where I've read more, that'll probably be something more I'm able to speak to or explore more. One of the things I will also say I found really valuable and helpful about, in particular in her writing on love, this is something that she, you know, was writing 20 years ago now, that maybe in the last two decades for a lot more people feels hopefully more obvious, but 20 years ago to me felt radical the first time I was introduced to ideas like these. And I probably first had an exposure not through bell hooks but through other people. But the notion, number one, that we've created this whole fairy tale of that love is first and foremost about romance, and that romance is primarily easy, and that it's just a matter of when you meet the right person then everything gets easy in life, and that the goal of life is to get paired off and partnered with one person. Bell Hooks is one in particular in her book All About Love, who spends time looking at like, okay, this thing that we call love is very, 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 very broad, and romance is a piece of it. But even there, it's not like, well, the problem is you have to meet the right person, and then everything clicks and it's magic and it's easy. It's about this very, very difficult process of honesty and vulnerability and always looking for how can I listen to the other person? And also what things do I need to say? And that's a both and for every partner in a relationship. And one of the things she takes shots at early on in her book, All About Love, it was written right around the time, maybe a little bit after, when that famous kind of self-help book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, came out, you know? And so like, she's like, okay, there's some insights that are helpful about, you know, we've been socialized to see the world, or, you know, to treat people differently or act differently. And yeah, broadly speaking, men are often socialized to act in this way, and women are often socialized to act this way. She's a voice who'd be like, okay, but even though there's differences between how men are trained to act in culture and women are trained to act in culture, that's not necessarily like a core essential. That's not inside. That's how we're trained to be by the wider culture. Not necessarily that's how all men and women actually are. And I think that's the problem, that folks read a book like that and said, oh, well, see, the problem is men are this way, all of them, and women are this way, all of them, rather than saying, no, those are helpful descriptions of the way our culture trains people to act. And if we live those scripts out and still find ourselves unhappy, is the problem I didn't live the script well enough? Or is the problem maybe these scripts are kind of made up, and maybe men don't just need to fix things and destroy things and hunt and gather things. Maybe we can't paint in that kind of broad brushstroke. And maybe women aren't only emotional and never logical. I mean, sometimes that can become crude caricatures of men are this and women are this. And I think one of the helpful critiques that Bell Hooks has offered, even as uncomfortable as it was to help her to see her pull the cover back, is how often, honestly, Christianity has kind of been used as a prop to sort of reinforce that script and be like, yeah, what it is to be Christian is to assume that women's job is to raise children and they're supposed to be emotional and men are supposed to be the earners and they're the ones who accomplish and build and conquer things. And Christianity is here to reinforce that, when I'm not really sure that's in particularly anywhere on Jesus' radar something he's particularly interested in. And an awful lot of even say, you know, Paul in Galatians is like, sorry, those rules don't have to be defining for us anymore, even though obviously Christianity has wrestled with and then at some points codified, no, the job of Christianity is to reinforce men do this and women do this. When that, to me, that feels like that's not what the gospel's about. That seems like that's an additional cultural thing that has strengths and weaknesses to it, but that ain't gospel. And so, like, Bell Hooks is a helpful voice, I think, for me at least, of all these assumptions that then got sort of propped up with, see, our religion says so. Maybe that's not really what love is really about, and that love isn't necessarily reducible to you'll be happy if you just find yourself in a romantic relationship. I say that that's been helpful for me, especially because often what I have experienced from life in the church is at some point folks, I think come to their expectation that the church's job is to like make their families work, or that sometimes mm-hmm. people like the job of the pastor is fix my marriage, or like, and again, like sometimes pastors are involved in helping folks through difficult times in relationships or dealing with family stuff, but that the voice that pastors can offer is not the same as clinical professional counseling, and that the role that a pastor can offer is, I don't think anymore, I don't know that I ever did, but I don't think that when families or marriages are going through difficult times, I don't think they primarily need someone to read Bible verses at them. And I think sometimes that's sort of the assumption of pop Christianity, that when a marriage is troubled, what somebody needs is they just need to get in church more and listen to more sermons and read more Bible stories. And when they do that, then the women will learn that they're supposed to cook and clean, and the men will learn that they're supposed to conquer and build, and everybody will be happy. And like, no, sometimes the issue is, we're not capable of truth telling with one another, or we're not capable of saying what we actually think, or maybe we're not capable of listening to something that's uncomfortable, or we don't bring the assumption that the other person gets an equal vote in how a family makes decisions. And that's not just a matter of you need to read more Bible verses. That's like, we need to like deconstruct the assumptions we bring about how every relationship uses power, I guess.
I read an article recently, and it was one of those, it was shared on Facebook, and I scrolled through the article right before bed, so I wish I'd read it more in-depthly now, but the gist of the article was that for the past 100 or so years, the American religion has seen the Christian church as a place that you go to for advice.
Yeah.
That you go to church to find, to get an advice on how to best read the Bible, on how to best pray, on how to best fix your relationship with your family.
Yeah.
And that is perhaps straying from the actual mission of the church, that we shouldn't be a center for advice, mm-hmm. that instead we should be, you know, the center for glorifying God, proclaiming Christ crucified and risen. You know, that and like looking at what Jesus actually wanted us to do, not how to best feel good.
And go ahead.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of what you were getting at with Bell Hooks and how she, I just lost my train of thought, but I think it was something along the, it's okay. It's, yeah, about looking at the assumptions of what is this institution for?
Yeah. And I appreciate the way, whether you or the article you'd read framed it as advice, that like even advice is an appealing way that like advice is the kind of thing you can feel free to take or not take, where, you know, like there was a time in Christian history and there were certainly downsides to the hierarchy and the downsides of medieval Christianity. But there was a time where the church wasn't advice giver. The church was, we decree, this is what you shall do. And in our modern therapeutic sort of era, it's sort of, well, I'm going to go to my church or my pastor or my small group leader when I'm having a problem. And then if I like their advice, I'll do it. And if I don't like their advice, I'm free to ignore it. And like, so like, while I'm not at all in favor of the church should be decreeing and demanding obedience, I think the advice approach feels distinctively American and consumerist, of sort of like, well, if I don't have any answers, I'll go and see what my church has to say and I'll try it. And if it doesn't work in like, you know, three easy applications, I'll move on to something else. And again, that feels very much like that's not what it is to be a disciple of a rabbi. You know, I will live my life the way the rabbis, you know, sketches out, here's how we live our lives, rather than I tried this and it was helpful, or I tried it and I didn't like it, or this was too hard, I gave up, that kind of thing. And that whole notion of church is here for advice feels very, I'm free to take it or leave it, and when it gets hard, I will abandon it, which again fits very much with, I think, our culture's approach to how love works, that love is it's the thing that will make my life all feel better. And if I'm having a struggle with it, it must be the relationship is bad or wrong. I found the wrong person who wasn't the one. I'll ditch them and find the one. And it feels to me like a whole lot of people grew up on fairy tales, often animated fairy tales, that were sort of basically that was the story. And it, like for me, this is one of those notes where it feels like the wider culture has been listening to what voices like bell hooks have been saying, and affected some of our storytelling. When my kids saw the movie Frozen that came out, now, oh my goodness, it's however many years that's been, but the retelling of the Snow Queen fairy tale, you know, and in Disney's recent retelling, it's not that true love is you have to find a man, and once you find your prince, then everything gets better. It turns out the love that makes the difference is the two sisters and their sacrificial love for one another. To me, that was mind-blowing, having grown up on all the Disney fairy tale movies of what you need is the right prince to come along, and then, you know, even though you've never met him, he kissed you when you were passed out, but now that was true love. And that sort of whole deconstructing, maybe love is something more than just you need to find the right romantic person for a moment and you'll know them by the way they kiss you. But that the love that might save the world might be self-sacrificial and sisterly or familial or community-wide, and is not about just romance. And like to me, I'm glad that my kids are growing up in a world where the movies they're seeing doesn't end with, and you're not a success until you find a romantic partner, and otherwise you're, you know, what a miserable life you're living. But it feels like those, it took a long time for voices to sort of percolate to like, wait a second, your life is not incomplete just because you have not found a quote unquote, the one, and maybe finding the quote unquote, the one isn't what makes life easy and happy. It commits you to a different kind of daily challenge and struggle.
Yeah, I would agree that the animated companies such as Disney has really stepped up their game in the last 10 years, you know, since I've stopped watching Disney movies because I was a kid and not a target audience, but now because I'm a parent and also because I still really like Disney movies. But like Moana, again, there is no romantic interest. Even in Frozen, there's still, you know, Anna who is trying to find a true love. But Moana, it's like, no, I'm too busy. Like, that's not even on the horizon. Like, that's not the main point. This is definitely, I need to save my people and also the ocean, because if the ocean doesn't survive, then the people don't survive. And so I need to save the ocean and the world. And so there isn't even any romantic love. But ultimately, I would say it's still a movie about love.
Right.
It's about her love for her people. It's her love for the world. And also her love of self.
Sure.
And who she understands herself to be and not who her parents want her to be. And she still loves her parents. It's not like she gets all mad and angry. Well, she does get mad, but she doesn't get all like angsty about like, oh, my parents don't understand me. It's more like, I know who they want me to be. I understand why they want me to be this way, but that's not who I am. That's not the voice in my head. Like, this is who I'm supposed to be. This is where I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to do. And I think that that understanding of yourself when it goes against everybody else is a type of love.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw a cartoon the other day that your insight makes me think of. It's a cartoon by David Hayward, Daniel Hayward. The cartoon, the gist of it is this kid going to his father and, like, you know, dad sitting in the easy chair like stereotypical dads do. And the caption is like, so it's the picture is a kid talking to his dad, but the caption is all the language we've been taught to pray to God as father. And it's sort of a, woe is me. I'm not even worthy to speak to you. I'm a worm. I'm a wretch, all that kind of thing. And I know I'm not worthy for you to listen to me. And it's sort of like, then the title of all this is like, if we think this would be weird with talking with our actual parents, why have we sort of accepted that, like, the right way to talk to God is I'm unworthy and I'm nothing. And I'm terrible. And I'm rotten and I'm a mistake and I'm off. Like, so, like, sometimes organized church is really good at, we're miserable sinners. There's nothing else to be said about us, but we're miserable sinners. Rather than, it's possible to be, again, both at the same time, beloved and broken, and to have sin that needs to be named and the truth told about it, but also still claimed and beloved. And sometimes our language in organized church life is, there's nothing good to say about me. Well, if we can tell that would not be a good way to run your household with, you know, actual parents and children, why would we want to reinforce that that's how humans relate to God? That, no, it's okay to say, here's something I need, or I need to say this about myself, or I need to own that I'm beloved and I'm worthy because God sees I'm worthy, not just I'm a worm and I'm terrible or something like that. That, like, you have to be able to say both at the same time rather than reinforcing only the you're terrible. So I guess I want to thank you both for listening to my sort of stumbling, rambling introduction to Bell Hooks. Are there other things, as you've just heard me describe this introduction, that are poking questions or anything else for either of you?
Yeah, I guess my question is, where would you suggest to be a good starting place for reading Bell Hooks?
Yeah. Well, this may just be that this is my entry and therefore it seems like an acceptable entry for others. But honestly, her All About Love in the beginning of that trilogy of books seems like a good place in a sense, in that it's a pretty broad place to enter. And it seems to me like doesn't require a lot of technical knowledge of any other areas or pieces of culture. And to me, like, I was honestly a little bit nervous before wading a little more deeply into her writing, being like, am I going to be able to relate to what she has to say? Somebody who comes from a different walk of life, who's got several decades of life, you know, life experience on me. And I found her writing to be accessible there and non-technical, and it wasn't intimidating. It wasn't like, sorry, if you don't check the same demographic boxes as me, don't even bother reading. It was, you know, everybody knows what it's like to want to be loved and to love and to get better at how to love and to be loved. So for me, that made it an easy place to begin. And then from there to see what trails are worth following down after that. That's what I'd say.
Okay. Thank you.
So I'll thank both of you for being willing to indulge me in this exploration. And we're going to get to have one more conversation with voices other than our own next time here in Crazy Faith Talk. Hope you can join us then.
See y'all.
Bye.